Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's time for our monthly legal roundtable, and today our panelists have a brand new Missouri Supreme Court justice to talk about. Governor Greitens made the choice using a method he does not like. The governor's also gotten himself involved in a big Missouri case before the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll be talking about that. Also, a lot of changes in personnel within the St. Louis criminal justice system. What will it mean for the system? In studio here are attorneys Bill Frivol, professor of journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor of students and director of the Career Center at Washington University. And with us once again is Jared Boyd, chief of staff and counsel to the St. Louis City Treasurer. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hi.
Well, let's start with the brand new Supreme Court justice here in the state of Missouri. Mark Smith, I'll turn to you for
sure.
That. What do we know about him?
Yeah, so I've not met the man, but he's lifelong Missourian, looks like, went to Mizzou Law School, did well there, and then worked at Latham & Gage. It's a big Kansas City-based firm, but they have an office here in St. Louis, and then was served about 15 years in the prosecutor's office in Platte County, then went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, where he did prosecutions because he was doing criminal work there, and then has been a circuit court judge, so a trial judge, for about, the last 7 years or so. So, I mean, he's got a good background to become a Supreme Court judge. Just in terms of interesting things, he said on his form he had never been sued. I don't know a lot of people of that age who've never been sued, so that's good. And he put down that he's very active in his home Catholic church, including coaching 7th and 8th grade, like baseball teams of girls and boys. So he's got to have a little bit of a saint in him if he can do that, because I've done that, and that's tough work. So.
He's a kid himself pretty much on the court.
Graduated from law school in 96, so that would make him in his mid-40s, early 40s.
One of the youngest, if not the youngest, on the court.
I think he is the youngest on the court, I believe.
Well, what do we know about him philosophically? I guess we can – it's one of the things about these appointments – the man on the street and woman on the street generally don't know much about them, but we know very little about this fellow.
Yeah, that's right. What I did look at, the lawyers' reviews of his, the lawyers who had appeared before him, how they rated him on the surveys that are handed out to try to evaluate judges, and he was rated very highly in almost all areas, you know. I think it's a 5-point scale, and he was over 4 in all of them. So the judges who have appeared before him were very positive. I read an opinion of his, and I really couldn't see whether it was a conservative or a liberal slant. It seemed pretty straightforward.
I think it's generally conceded that he's probably on the conservative side of the spectrum. Wouldn't you think, Jared?
I can't speak to his jurisprudence, but I assume that he is on the conservative side of the spectrum. I believe one of the Senate leaders remarked that this gentleman is very qualified. However, he wishes that the entire process by which we appoint Supreme Court justices gets reformed, and that in this instance, there was only one candidate that fit the criteria that he was looking for. And I assume this is the gentleman that he was referring to in that one candidate.
Yeah, and he added to that, this was Richard, the what, House Speaker?
Senate leader
said that he hoped next time all three, would be conservatives.
We're talking about the nonpartisan court plan, which is a national
supposedly
model.
You're right. And he wants Richard wants to get rid of the nonpartisan court plan. It would appear from his comments, as you just said, Don. It's called the Missouri plan because it was the model for the nation to try to take partisanship as great extent as possible out of the selection of judges.
And whether or not the Missouri nonpartisan court plan is reformed, I think this puts a great deal of pressure on the commission that selects the three candidates to come up with conservative candidates in order to maintain the system.
To preserve it, correct.
Yes. And I would imagine that you will see more people with Federalist Society in their application featured prominently. And you will see more conservatives that make the three-person panel with the Supreme Court, with Court of Appeal openings, and even Circuit Court openings.
Yeah. Now, Justice Judge Powell had worked for a year for Senator Bond back in, I think, 92, 93, around in there, between college and law school. But I didn't see anything, any mention of Federalist Society. And Federalist Society is the big kind of conservative legal society that's very active in law schools. Scalia was a big, advocate for the Federalist Society. And there's also now the American Constitution Society, which is kind of the liberal alternative.
Right. We should point out Governor Greitens also wants this plan replaced, reformed, modified, whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's speaking of the governor, he has gotten himself involved in a case that was argued before the Supreme Court just a couple of weeks ago. That's the Trinity Lutheran case. It's just to refresh everyone's memory. This is the institution, the church, looking for a Missouri grant to purchase recycled rubber for the playground. We've talked about this in the past, and this was argued, but the governor came out and said subsequently that he's in favor of church or the state funds going to institutions like this. Now people are saying this is going to render moot whatever the Supreme Court comes up with.
Well, so the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this last week, and one of the this issue came up about whether or not the Greitens action would make it moot. It appears as though most of the justices on the Supreme Court did not think that it made it moot. As the lawyer for Missouri who was arguing the old Missouri position that the rubberized material could be denied to the church, the lawyer arguing that said it wasn't moot because Greitens' changing of the regulations could be challenged in court and thrown out. So it's not a controversy that really goes away. And it appeared as though a majority of the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court lean towards the view that Missouri could not discriminate against this Trinity Lutheran Daycare Center in providing state benefit like this rubberized material. The reason the state had denied that to the church, to Trinity Lutheran, was because of there's a state constitutional amendment that requires very strict separation of church and state, stricter than the U.S. Constitution right. requires. And it says there can be no direct or indirect state aid to a church. And so it was on that basis that Trinity Lutheran was disqualified from this rubberized playground equipment program, but it seems as though a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court justices see this as religious discrimination. The Missouri constitutional amendment involved is called the Blaine Amendment. About 30-plus states adopted those amendments in the late 1800s. It was sort of an anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant campaign to get those adopted. So the origins of that legislation are sort of tainted.
I was surprised by oral arguments. A lot of court watchers indicated that this would be a close case. But during oral arguments, Kagan and Breyer really went down a line of questioning with Layton, who's representing the state, that seemed to indicate that they are leaning towards granting Trinity Lutheran or weighing in favor of Trinity Lutheran, particularly with kind of the arbitrary line drawing that the state is trying to distinguish between this type of services that churches are eligible for, like police and fire services, and this service for helping kids play on safe playground equipment. So I really was struck by Kagan and Breyer during oral arguments. Kagan said something to the effect of, "This is a clear burden on a constitutional right because individuals and groups are barred from competing for an otherwise neutral benefit." So she seemed to be strongly signaling where she's going to come out on this case.
Everyone was kind of thinking they were holding up this case because it was 4-4 and we needed new justice. But I think it's going to be probably a 7-2 decision because it sounded like Ginsburg and Sotomayor were the only ones that were buying the state of Missouri argument, which it's interesting note was being argued by the Solicitor General of Missouri, because Hawley's kind of excused himself. Everyone's backing away from this because the new people, they don't support it.
And, of course, the new justice on the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, is thought to most likely be you know, in favor of the Trinity Lutheran position. Gorsuch is very strong on religious liberty. He wrote the appeals court decision in the Hobby Lobby case, you know, that involved religious freedom.
He's only been on the court now for a very, very short period of time. But given this fact, he did ask some questions, which we know about, and the fact that he was involved in the Arkansas execution situation and voted in favor of execution, at least one case that I'm aware of. Do we know any really more about him now as a result of this very brief period on the court than we knew before?
I think he's doing what everyone kind of expected. He's taking a pretty originalist conservative viewpoint. Apparently, he's showing a sense of humor, and he's actively involved.
But it'll take a long time.
Yeah.
It'll take a long time. I can remember the first term of David Souter, everybody who people thought was going to be very conservative the first term. He seemed very conservative. He ended up being quite middle of the road or liberal. Same thing, Harry Blackmun. You know, everybody said, oh, he's just a twin of Warren Burger. It turned out, you know, he wrote Roe versus Wade and became one of the most liberal justices on the court. Now, I'm not saying that Gorsuch is going to have that transformation, but he could go as far as, say, Anthony Kennedy has gone towards the middle. We'll see.
The other issue that I wanted to get to, a couple of national things here, is a federal judge has ruled against President Trump's executive order with regard to sanctuary cities. And that has some relevance here because Alderman Antonio French in the St. Louis Board of Aldermen is proposing that St. Louis establish itself as such. So what does this all mean? It's a temporary deal, as far as I can make out, with regard to the
federal
order. Well,
it is, but it has a national effect. I mean, it's one of these injunctions that a district court judge or stays that a district court judge issues that has national effect. What the judge is basically saying is that the order, the sanctuary cities order that was issued by Trump and the threat to cut off federal funds to sanctuary cities – was that if you read that order together with the statements that the president and that Attorney General Sessions had made, it appeared as though all kinds of federal funding for these sanctuary cities was at risk. And the judge was saying that the president doesn't have the power to control spending. That's Congress's power.
Right.
The president seems to possibly be violating the separation of powers by putting these kind of restrictions on the spending. And so that if the Trump sanctuary order is as broad as Trump and Sessions were indicating and threatens all of this federal funding to, in this case, San Francisco and Santa Clara County, California, that would have cut like 30% of their budget, well, then he's violating the separation of church and state. The fallback is that the government said, well, we didn't really mean that. You know, we just meant it to apply the cutoff of funds to apply to a couple of Justice Department and Homeland Security programs that it's been that's been the case in the past before there was any Trump administration. And so the government argument ended up there, and the judge said, well, you know, if that's all you're doing, you can do that. Mm-hmm. But you cannot go to all these other programs that involve millions of dollars of federal funding.
Jared, what happens now? This is a temporary order. At some point, there's going to have to be some action. What is it likely to be?
I'm sure it will be appealed, but I was amazed in this case how quickly the government lawyers cut and run from Trump's executive order. They immediately conceded that the president does not have the right to withhold federal funding for states that do not comply, states or localities that do not comply, with the exception of three Department of Justice grants, because those grants specifically spell out eligibility and compliance with the section that says that local officials cannot be prevented from communicating with ICE. So essentially the government was arguing that Trump's statement was meaningless, and it basically reinforced what folks already knew that applied for those Department of Justice grants, which was very interesting posture to argue in that case. I think it does provide a lot of jurisdictions with clarity that federal funding cannot be withheld. And I think it is interesting, too, that you see these sanctuary cities, quote unquote, that are using conservative legal precedent
yeah.
that typically is used to check federal authority, and conservatives typically want to provide more authority to states and localities. So you have cases like the Medicaid expansion case, where the government was prevented from expanding Medicaid premised on spending. So you're using those cases to now check Donald Trump.
Yeah, and the thing I would just say about this, you know, a lot of people talk about sanctuary city. I've seen our students at WashU talking about sanctuary, and it's a very amorphous term, and it means different things to different
people.
It
needs definition, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also, what are they called, the welcoming cities, wasn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah, the welcoming city. And so I think, I mean, one thing to kind of know is a lot of times what people, what local officials are saying they don't want to do is to honor ICE, what are called detainer requests, and their requests. There, no judge has, and so maybe a city has a person in custody, the person's going to be released, and ICE says, well, we want you to hold them for us. But ICE doesn't have a judge's order, so, I mean, this person has rights. If you hold them illegally, they could sue the city. There are costs, associated with holding somebody. The feds don't come in and compensate that. So many of these cities are saying, whether they call themselves sanctuary cities or not, they're just saying, let us run our business, and you federal government do your own thing. But we don't want to have – and then you also hear these arguments about we don't want to – we're not going to make our police officers ask everyone their citizenship because it would – it have a chilling effect on people reporting crimes, and it would just keep us from doing our job. But I know people who think we're being too lax on immigration see that as, well, you're being lax. But I think there are good there are reasonable arguments on both sides.
For those who don't know, by the way, ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Incorrect, yeah.
And Santa Clara actually wanted to work with ICE with certain violent offenders, but they did a cost-benefit analysis. They realized ICE was not going to repay them for the detainers, and they realized that ICE or the federal government would not indemnify Santa Clara against any lawsuits for Fourth Amendment violations. So they decided that they could not work with ICE.
And some of the specific situations where ICE has complained, oh, you didn't – it turned out, yeah, they did deliver them. But, so it's a complicated issue.
And President Trump has tweeted this morning about how ridiculous these are, and he'd see you in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and he might be regretting some comments he made about justices and jurists a few months ago. Hey, we have to take a break. We'll do that now. This is Legal Roundtable Day. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Jared Boyd in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. Story there once again concerning Ferguson. That story just doesn't go away in one form or another. And we're back at it here because Attorney General Sessions has basically indicated that he wants to review some of the agreements between the Justice Department and police departments that could involve the consent decree concerning the Ferguson and the Michael Brown shooting. What does this mean?
Well, I think that I noticed that Kim Norwood, who's Washington U law professor, who's on the sort of the panel that's overseeing that consent decree, was saying she doesn't think that Judge Catherine Perry would agree to watering down the consent decree. I mean, Sessions has said, he wants this more police-friendly approach. He thinks some of these consent decrees are based upon, not very detailed studies. I mean, he may not have read the Ferguson study, which is was just a – I mean, I remember sitting out in the newsroom reading this thing and just being horrified at the amount of evidence of unconstitutional activities by both the police in Ferguson and the court system there. It was a devastating report with all sorts of evidence and statistics to back it up. So, I cannot see – a consent decree is like an agreement. The judge isn't going to just let the federal government out of the agreement. And I question whether, you know, Attorney General Sessions is he's the Attorney General. He should be enforcing the federal law that requires investigations of patterns and practices of police misconduct. That's the law since Rodney King.
Is he overstepping his mandate, do you think, Jared?
I think his mandate comes from a law and order president, one. But two, I agree with Bill in the sense that these consent decrees, the ones that have already been entered into, require judicial sign-off for any material changes, and I don't foresee judges being inclined to do that. However, for future consent decrees, the biggest hammer that you have is threat of a Department of Justice pattern or practice lawsuit, and that is often what compels cities or other municipalities to enter into these consent decrees. And Attorney General Sessions talks about how it's costly to have monitors, which is true, but Chicago has also seen that it's very costly to have a police force that doles out $210 million in settlements to people who have suffered at the hands of police officers. So while Attorney General Sessions does raise some issues with the cost of monitoring and increasing morale among police departments, he does have to deal with the reality of police brutality lawsuits and community buy-in for actually dealing with law enforcement issues at the local level.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I don't think that the agreements are going to be undone. But having said that, the agreements are between the Justice Department and the municipalities, and they could kind of die a slow death because nobody's going to be pushing to make sure everything's done. And you'll have outsiders who may or may not have standing trying to enforce it. And it certainly will be different than when you had a more activist Justice Department.
Let me back up just a second. I had mentioned it just before the break to Bill that Donald Trump may be rethinking some of the comments he made critical of the judiciary some weeks back. Is there anything to that? I mean, he's got a lot of things going in various courts now and stands to lose a lot. Do you think judges could be gunning for him in any sense of the word?
Well, I mean, there's two ways in which I think you're right. One way is that in both the Sanctuary City decision opinion and earlier in the travel ban opinion, it was statements that Trump himself and his top people had made that were relied upon by the courts as being really showing what was the intention of the order, and that those statements were the reasons that they were not.
Where they found the animus,
questionable.
Basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's it's hurting him in court. And, you know, I mean, a judge like, well, remember in the confirmation hearings, Judge Gorsuch said, you know, it made him feel really terrible that whenever he hears a politician make that kind of a comment. And, you know, judges don't like that. So I don't think it certainly doesn't help him. I don't think a judge would, you know, mean to rule against a president just because the president has been disrespectful. But it sure doesn't help. Yeah.
Particularly when the president's saying, you can't tell me what to do. I can do whatever I want. I'm the president. Well, that's not how our system works. And I mean, it's like your kid telling me I'm going to do this. And you're going to say, no, I might have negotiated with you before, but now that's done. The hammer's dropping.
I've mentioned on this program before a conversation I had off the record with a prominent judge here in St. Louis who said the president has made a big mistake because we're not going to forget this.
Yeah.
Made it very clear in my mind that what we're talking about has some traction.
And I would think for those judges, they're not just getting back at Donald Trump, but they're defending our American system. And it's when you've got somebody saying, I don't need to follow the system. I'm bigger than the system. I think that's going to get there.
And my judge says this is the way the system is supposed to work.
Right,
there
exactly.
are three branches. Okay, let's move on. Lots going on in the city of St. Louis this past week or two with regard to a change in administration. Let me just cite a couple of things that have happened. We've had the police chief who's been removed from office. Resigned is the technical word. He's no longer the police chief, regardless of how you want to put it. We have Nicole Hudson, who has been appointed by Mayor Crewson in a job to deal with racial equity in the city. We've got Kim Gardner, 100 days in office as the prosecuting attorney. By the way, Jennifer Joyce is opening a consulting firm to help these people out.
I thought she was going to travel around the country doing good deeds.
That's got to stop sometime, apparently.
I had a vision of her like Kane from Kung Fu, doing and wandering, and it was going to be great, but I guess that gets old.
I hope she's listening. She'll address that personally with you.
I haven't seen the Winnebago. I'm anxious to see the Winnebago.
Maybe they're taking a break and they're going out.
It could be, but she is going to hang a shingle with a former colleague. And we've got Mayor Crewson saying she wants to take the police department in a new direction. So, big changes in the criminal justice system here. What does it mean? Are they really big changes, or is it going to be business as usual? Does anybody have a sense for that? Jared, maybe you have your office in City Hall, right? What are you hearing?
I think it is too early to determine the direction of this administration. But it's interesting that with the demise of with the gaining of local control for the police department, we made the chief of police a civil service official, which provided him with a great deal of leverage in potentially negotiating his exit, because you would have to prove that for cause in order to terminate him. So you can't just say that I disagree with what he's doing. You'd have to go through the civil service process of getting rid of him for cause, which probably provided him with the protections that most city employees provide, but also some leverage in negotiating his exit.
I find the Nicole Hudson appointment particularly interesting in this context, because she, of course, was a part of the Ferguson Commission and forward through Ferguson. And an awful lot of the work that they did had to do with police tactics and police process and procedures. So,
and also at looking through at things in the region through a racial lens. I mean, if we do A, how will it affect, people who have been kind of taken advantage of by the system? How will it affect black people, not just how will it affect white people? And I think that's a good thing to do, because you get your own lens on and you start thinking about, well, I think this is good for me, but you need to think more broadly. And so just having somebody in there who's asking that question all the time.
Yeah, I think the world of Nicole, and I think there's probably aren't very many people who understand what happened in Ferguson and sort of the meaning of it going forward than she. I spent about 2 hours with her last summer explaining where she was explaining to me sort of like all of the different activists and activist groups that had become activated by all the events in Ferguson. Maybe 20 some odd groups or activists who are working together, and I mean, she really understands what's going on. I think that the police chief had sort of lost the confidence of at least the African American community, and it was probably a good time for him to go. And I think the new circuit attorney is doing some things that are look like good ideas. Well, she's negotiating apparently with the public defenders on some of the nonviolent cases to try to avoid trials. She's talking, as Jennifer Joyce did, about protecting witnesses. Trying to take steps to do that, and going out with the police and trying to work on prosecutors and police going out trying to work on police community relations. So I think her election was one of the manifestations of this group of young activists who emerged in St. Louis as a result of Ferguson.
Right.
Nicole Hudson was on this program a week or so ago, and one of the things she said that impressed me, and it's been published, is she's a senior advisor, and she insisted on having that title because she didn't want anybody to think that she was just being brought in as some sort of a token, if you will, if I can use that word, that she was serious about what she wanted to do in terms of getting some things done that need to be done in the city of St. Louis.
You know, this the Sam Dotson change, I mean, the talk is now about bringing in somebody from outside the department. That could be a very dramatic change because you've got a system where, every chief has come up through the ranks and came up through the ranks where it was a very political system. When I was on the police board, they would talk about officers who had steam, which meant they had a political backer. And it was just kind of the way things were done. And you went along to get along. And And if you get somebody kind of new and from the outside who could shake things up, but I think the police department really needs help. They're way understaffed. I think their manpower is something like 1,100, and they're a couple hundred down. They're a couple hundred down, and that's huge. When I was on the board in what was that, like around 2000, our commission strength was 1,500. I mean, that's a big change, and the city of St. Louis hasn't changed, and crime is worse.
Yeah.
They got a tough job, the cops.
No question. Got to take another break. Let's do that now. It's Legal Roundtable Day. We'll come back and continue our conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Jared Boyd, Bill Freivogel, and Mark Smith. I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on this, but I'm sure you've read that former Governor Rod Blagojevich has lost another attempt to have his sentence of 14 years for wrongdoing while in the governor's office reduced somewhat. On what grounds do we go for a sentence reduction?
Well, the grounds he was arguing is he had like about 100 letters from inmates where he is in prison saying that he is an amazingly rehabilitated person who is an inspiration in their lives. The judge rejected that on the basis of that none of those people knew him when he was the governor.
Plus,
and doing,
he put together
bad things.
A jailhouse band. You forgot that part, Bill.
The jailhouse band. I'm sorry.
The jailhouse rockers, and he wanted credit for that.
Another thing he argued was that, well, the appeals court had thrown out, I guess it was like five of the convictions.
Right.
The ones related to a deal relating to the old Obama Senate seat, and that because those he had never been and the prosecutor decided not to retry him on that. And because of that, there should be a reduction in the sentence. But the judge said, well, even the ones you've been convicted on, where the convictions are still good, if we plug this into the sentencing recommendations, you're still at 14 years. And just that the judge thought that it was really important, the district judge who resentenced thought it was really important that there be an example set for future governors of Illinois. And
right.
Heavens knows that it'd be nice to have an example set. So, and then
I think this trial judge had kind of, like at his sentencing, said you had disfigured, that Blagojevich had disfigured Illinois. And like you said, on the appeal, they get rid of five of the 18 counts that he was convicted of, and they send it back down. And while they said, well, he could have lessened, he certainly was not obligated to, and so we're fine with it.
And Blagojevich is far from a sympathetic character,
yeah.
But it's difficult for me to believe this is the most corrupt instance in Illinois history for which he received, I think, the longest sentence for public corruption.
It is a long sentence.
Yeah, 14 years, right?
For a nonviolent offense
that
for a person who does not have a prior criminal record, it is a long sentence.
Well, his attitude and his actions during this process before and after the trial.
I think this was probably a real blow, though. This suggests he's going to do the time. I mean, not the full 14 years because he'll get out early.
85% of that or whatever.
But it's not going to get cut down to 5 years or something like that.
So who does he follow? We've got Dan Walker, who did a little time, right, as a former governor. Otto Koerner, didn't he do a little time?
I think he did time.
George Ryan.
Yeah.
George Ryan, absolutely, absolutely.
Have we missed anybody?
Probably.
What about the Walken governor?
Is that Dan Walker? Dan Walker?
Yeah.
You're not thinking of Walken Joe Teasdale.
They served at the same time. I remember once when they were both walking and they met on the Eads Bridge. It was a big deal. Of course, all the television stations were there. All righty, let's move on to free speech in Berkeley. UC Berkeley, the birthplace, as some people would put it, of free speech in this country. Ann Coulter, the conservative columnist, was scheduled to speak there. Students say, no, we don't want any part of her. Is this a free speech issue?
Yes.
I'm going to disagree with
Bill,
so you go first.
Go. I think the Berkeley should be ashamed of itself, not taking the steps it needs to take to provide a place for her to speak when she's been invited by the College Republicans. College Republicans have filed a lawsuit based on the First Amendment, and I think that I think they have a very strong case. I mean, there's something in First Amendment law that's called the heckler's veto. You know, we don't allow hecklers who do not like a public speaker to cause the cancellation of the speaker because they're being rowdy. And that's exactly what the what Berkeley allowed here. They allowed the heckler's veto from the violent actions of that occurred during the during a previous speech. They allowed that to cause them to cancel this speech. And I think it's a violation of the First Amendment.
Okay. Fear of violence, basically.
Fear of violence.
I don't disagree with anything Bill said, but this is – I've worked with student groups before. Student groups have great intentions, but they're not always really good on details or thinking through. And so this is what I suspect happened. Reading stories in the – what is it? The Daily California and the Berkeley newspaper and stuff. These kids invite her out, but they don't have a room reserved or anything. And then the school, from what I understand, the school was saying, this is not a good time because it's the last week of classes. Yeah. Why don't we do it next week? Then we
when
can
all
get
the kids are gone.
No, they're not gone. They're studying.
Oh, they're studying.
It's reading week. They're all around. And there's a lot more freedom in terms of – and we can put it in a place where we can make security. And so then she's saying, well, I'm just going to do it out in the big open area. And it's – you know, Berkeley's a porous campus like WashU is, like SLU is, like SIU. And so – they know they're going to be outsiders coming in, and they need to keep their students safe, and they need to keep her safe. So I think this is more about mechanics, and then everyone's using it to try and say, look at Berkeley, the home of free speech, is denying speech they don't like. I don't think that's what's happening.
Well, you at Washington University, you can do whatever you want. You're a private university.
I know, but
this is a public university.
I
they're under the First Amendment. You're not.
No, but I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, but you still have to – do it in a safe way, and you can't just have some chucklehead kids who say, hey, look at who we brought in, and it's like, what?
They can be safe without canceling the speech.
This case made me think of two things. One, the Ferguson injunction against standing just in the middle of the street. Because there is a balance between regulating free speech and regulating public safety that can be difficult in some respects. And I think this case will come down to whether or not Berkeley treats conservatives like Ann Coulter like other high-profile, perhaps controversial figures that are on the left or of a different persuasion. But Berkeley is saying that they really don't have a formal policy for dealing with these type of speakers, which is in contradiction with what the conservative students are stating in this case.
Right. By the way, Ann Coulter is on campus today, as I understand
the students then withdrew. And that's the thing. These facts seem to be changing very rapidly, and they're in conflict. But I had heard that the student group withdrew their invitation. She said she was coming anyway. Mm-hmm.
Just before went on the air, I saw a note on my cell phone that said she had canceled. So I don't
know. Really?
That could be the most
And, you know, this gets all the press, but we had a situation at WashU a couple of weeks ago. A student group brought in a very conservative speaker that was taking kind of a religious view towards gay marriage that a lot of students disagreed with. So rather than drowning out the speakers, students who had a different point of view had a separate speaker in a separate room in the same building.
Yeah.
And that's and I think that's what universities want. And I mean, we don't want to shut down speech and us privates.
How did Phyllis Schlafly's speech go at Washington University?
She didn't give a speech. She got an award. I was at that. It was some students.
She actually did get it because there was an awful lot of conversation about her not being there.
She got an award 1 year. Gloria Steinem got an award another year. Everyone gets an award. I haven't gotten one, but.
All right, let's move on. Jared, I know this is something you were interested in, and that is that the powers that be in the city of St. Louis are suing the NFL over the Rams' departure. There's a word used in all of this. Let's see. It's the city of St. Louis, the Regional Convention and Sports Authority, RSA, suing the NFL. The city and RSA requested the court award them disgorgement of NFL profits. Now, that's a new word to me. What does that mean?
A lot of money.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the NFL has it.
Yes.
We know that. Yeah. Tell us your thoughts on this suit.
I think that the suit is interesting for a variety of reasons. One, the law firms that are representing the city and RSA are taking this on a contingency fee basis. So if, in fact, the city does get a large amount of money, whether it be reimbursement for the professional services in developing the renderings for the Riverfront Stadium or a portion of the increase in value of the Rams, they would get perhaps a third of that amount of money. But I also think it's interesting because the city is not a contractual party to the NFL, but we're bringing a breach of contract claim. But the petition itself is very damning against the Rams in terms of the statements that they made publicly to fans and other officials versus the timeline by which they selected and moved to Los Angeles, whether it be inducing Jeff Fisher to come to the Rams because
the former coach had
gone through a relocation process, or dealing with the acquisition of the property in Inglewood. Apparently Stan Kroenke called Kevin Dimoff and told them this is perfect for football, and then Dimoff told fans actually this would be a terrible site for football. So there's several of these statements from a time perspective that seem very damning against the Rams. But whether or not there's a legal remedy for being kind of a bad actor is another question that the courts will certainly sort out.
There's five counts. Some of them are breach of contract where you just get your damages. But some of them are intentional torts where you can also get punitive damages. And that's where you really make money. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be interesting to see. And they're not just suing Kroenke. They're suing the other team owner, saying you have all these agreements. You didn't follow almost like a notice and comment type of provision before you move your team. I think they accused the Dallas owner of kind of encouraging Kroenke to start looking at Inglewood for his stadium. So it's going to be an interesting case. And you know, the depositions, the discovery period is just going to be nonstop fun.
It would seem to me, and I'm the only non-lawyer in the room, that this would be a case that would probably be to the advantage of the NFL to settle rather than go through the whole process and have all this dirty laundry washed out in public.
It might be.
Yeah.
The sort of legal question is to what extent were Singles officials entitled to rely on these misleading statements that – you know, the team owners and Kroenke and other people speaking for Kroenke made about how St. Louis is great and we're not about to do this. Yeah, I think the Rams would take the position that, the St. Louis officials should be a little more sophisticated than that.
I mean, the other thing, just think about the legal costs. I should know. How many teams are in the NFL? I don't even know.
32.
Okay. So each one is going to have their lawyer there with their associate with them. So that's $1,000 an hour for a deposition, plus the other – just an eight-hour deposition is going to cost, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you start thinking, maybe we just settle this, make it go away. I think there were a lot of fees incurred in planning this new stadium. If they could get those back, maybe at a little bit more, they might take it.
Has any number been put out there as with regard to how much this could possibly generate?
Well, I think the fees associated with planning the new stadium were around $16 million.
Yeah. But the Rams, they said, increased in value by, $700 million or something like that?
$3 billion.
The Rams increased in value?
Yeah.
Yes.
The Rams?
by going there to a larger market.
And then the NFL owners receive $550 million in the relocation fee, which they don't have to share with the players.
We are talking some
serious
money out there. Okay, let's move on. Time is winding down. I did want to bring in the fact we know that the Missouri State Legislature is working on a couple of things with regard to abortion, but the Missouri abortion standards that have existed for a while now have been ruled against by a U.S. district judge. What does that mean, or does it mean anything beyond this particular set of standards?
Well, it means Missouri's got to begin complying with what the Constitution says. I mean, this you remember last last spring there was a Texas case that had
whole women's health, right?
Right. Yeah. Texas had a lot of the same rule. They had the same rules. You know, you had to a doctor had to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. The abortion clinics had to meet surgical standards. U.S. Supreme Court said that's a violation of a woman's right to choose. Now a federal judge in Missouri has said Missouri's law violates that too. As a result, it appears as though Planned Parenthood is going to start up clinics in Columbia and Joplin and Springfield. They were down to just one clinic in St. Louis. Greitens says we're going to appeal. The Attorney General says we're going to appeal. This is you know, bad law. I mean, that's crazy. This is clearly what the Supreme Court said in Texas.
Yeah.
And the record was very strong in Texas because they originally had 40 abortion clinics,
yeah,
went to 20, and then before the full effect of the law would go into place, or if the full effect of the law would go into place, they would be down to 10. Yeah. So I think you will see more clinics that are open in St. Louis. However, there still are a series of restrictions. For instance, I think we still have a 72-hour waiting period for abortion in Missouri. So there still are a series of restrictions on abortion. I think this just deals with surgical center issues and a few other things that deal with admitting privileges. So there still are a series of restrictions in Missouri on abortion.
If I remember correctly, in Texas, women were being forced to travel hundreds of miles.
Because it's such a big state. Yeah,
yeah.
There was areas. I mean, I was teaching the abortion cases a couple of weeks ago and was rereading, and you're right, the whole women's health is clearly controlling of this situation. But when you read this with the Casey decision, with the Roe, you see the Supreme Court, I mean, they're kind of all over the board. And, you know, with Gorsuch being on the Supreme Court, and we've talked about this before, but, you know, if Ginsburg retires or something else happens, there could be some major changes. And we've come close before to a reversal or a big cutback on Roe versus Wade. And I think it's not possible in the future.
Jeffrey Toobin, whom we all know and respect for the work that he's done, the writings he's done on the court, he was on a Fresh Air, I guess, a week or two ago. And he was talking about this and the prospect for someone like Justice Ginsburg to retire. She's 84 years old. And he said to Terry Gross, he says, Terry, he said, 84 is not the new anything. 84 is old.
Yeah.
You know, and that's,
and she's
not
in the best of health either. I mean,
I think I wouldn't be entirely surprised to see Justice Kennedy retire, and him retiring would numbers-wise be the same as Ginsburg retiring.
Right, right.
Because he's in the majority. He wrote the Texas case.
I think you're right.
He either wrote it or he assigned it. He may have assigned it to Breyer, but he was in the majority.
Only a few seconds left, but going back to the abortion issue, Planned Parenthood is not out of the woods yet because the federal funding is an issue, too, that has to have some impact one way or another with regard to what's going on in Washington. That's going to pretty much do it for today, guys. Any final thought before we say goodbye?
Did you hear a cell phone went off at the Supreme Court? It turned out to be
Justice Breyer.
Breyer, right. But we get a pass if one of our cell phones goes off.
We had one go off in this room one day with barnyard sounds. I'm sure that gave the audience quite a wake-up call, if, pardon the pun intended. Thank you so much. Mark Smith, great to see you again. Jared Boyd, thank you for being with us once
more.
Thank you. Bill Freivogel, great to see you as well. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.